This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We all want a better life. We want life to be perfect. So down through history, of course, people have sought to create the ideal society, utopia. But if you take a look around, you will see we haven't quite gotten there yet, though it doesn't stop us from trying. Monologist Mike Daisy is interested in the concept of utopia, particularly the many and varied ways that we have tried to create ideal societies. They thought about Disney World, the Burning Man Festival, and Zuccotti Park, to name three. American Utopias is the subject of Mike Daisy's new show. Duke Performances brought him to town. He's on stage tonight through Sunday at PSI Theater of the Durham Arts Council, and Mike Daisy is in our studio now. Welcome. Good to have you back here.
Oh, good to be here.
You're a monologist, so you think that you should only have one spouse, I guess. Oh, forgive me. I'm so sorry. Actually, you think about that. You think that monologist would be better.
I do. I prefer the hard G. According to the OED, they're both valid pronunciations, so I'm pushing monologist, because I feel like monologist sounds like gynecologist, and I just think it's not. I just think it's more appealing.
I don't know if they would sell more tickets or not.
I don't know that it would, but I'm still pushing the other one.
Tell us about this American Utopias. Where'd you get this idea?
Well, you know, I all my monologues kind of grow out of pursuing my obsessions, and so what happened very specifically is that relatives of mine that I love very much are nominally Catholic. But really, they're Disney. Like, they worship Disney. They worship the mouse.
It's a fine distinction. It's only,
it is. Yeah. It is. They worship the mouse. They make a Hajj every 4 or 5 years. They all go en masse down to Disney World, and they're very, very serious about it. Yeah. And they were kind enough to extend an invitation to me to go with them and participate in their religious rites at Disney World. And I accepted. And I mean, I did it their way. And so that actually started the path, because as soon as I realized I wanted to talk about Disney World and what it meant to them and what it means to a lot of people, for me, like almost immediately, I realized I wanted to talk about Burning Man, which I had also never been to and is outside of my normal cultural sphere, this festival that happens in the desert with a huge amount of invention where people come and they build a city. 58,000 people build a city in the desert over a single week, and then they disassemble it and in the process consume a huge number of drugs and have a lot of sex and a wide variety of other kind of crazy things happen. And I was really enchanted by the idea of talking about utopias not as a sort of civic planning document, but as a dreamscape that people participate in, and like what it means to create these spaces. And so I started working on both those ideas. And while I was working on the show, Occupy Wall Street happened. And I saw that you could see that as the same kind of anthropological phenomenon beyond the political implications, like what it means to take over that space for the people who are in it.
And occupy it with an idea as well as the people who share that idea. Well, let's get back to Disney World as a religion, because it does seem to me that if it were a religion, it's all resurrection without the crucifixion. Did you say?
Yes, it is. And you know, what's interesting about Disney as a religion is, you know, that it's really a cult of nostalgia. It's an incredible nostalgia, and it has built into it the seeds of any good religion that you are automatically compelled to pass it on to your children. Just as you were brought to Disney World, you will in turn have children, and then you will bring those children. And as part of that cult, that is why the rides never change. It's actually important that if a ride was terrible when you went on it in 1976, it needs to be equally terrible in 2013. So then you can introduce it to your children and be like, this was lame when I went on it, and now it is lame for you. And you and the children, they will find their own rides that are lame. And like in this way, we pass along a kind of spiritual DNA.
So and it's brilliant in a way, because there's an actual nostalgia. I did this, and here's the way it happened. And then there's that kind of Disney nostalgia about a world that never existed, never will. But we create it in a way that makes you think it's always been here, that this is our world, or that it was the world the way it was.
Yes.
Kind of Reagan's nostalgia about America that never was.
Well, I'm always fascinated by how fully those original, through the golden age of Disney, starting with Snow White and going all the way to Fantasia, occupied our imagination, like really took control of that landscape, because now we sort of perceive them, all that iconography, as cliched. But that's simply because it has done such an incredible job of taking over. Like all those mythologies, all those Grimm stories had a multitude of interpretations and ways of being. They had a multitude of interpretations, some of which were even feminist and provocative, but not anymore. I mean, they really were taken and molded. And it's an impressive thing to talk about how right. one person can have an idea like that, because, you know, it's become so part of our lives. The idea itself that, like, you think about a man being like, I'm a filmmaker, I make these cartoons. You know what the world needs? A big park where the cartoons are real and you can walk around among them. This is actually a very strange idea. Like, it worked out so well that it seems normal now, but it's actually super provocative.
Right. But so that really brings, you know, brings you to this idea that utopia can never be, because it can only be in your head. And so our misery is matching our real experience against this ideal template, this thing that's in our head, and then foolishly trying to make it on the ground, you know, when the mouse, you know, his ears fall off and who knows what else is going on with that mouse.
Well, in a sense, it's foolish. But on the other hand, it's sort of an essentially human foolishness. Like all utopias are bounded, and they're either bounded by chronology and time, or they're bounded by space. Like, they can't go on forever. That's really true. And that maybe that's why I'm so interested in studying these kinds of utopias. They're worlds that we all agree to participate in for a time. And so within that time, we can give ourselves over fully to them. You know, no one could be at Burning Man all year long. They would go crazy. But for one week, it's a fascinating exercise to be in a completely different context.
Tell us more about Burning Man and how that would compare and contrast to, say, Disney World.
Well, I actually think that they're fairly similar experiences. I mean, they're very, very different in the particulars and the kinds of people they call to, but they both call on people who sort of shape part of their lives, are dedicated to making a pilgrimage out to a location. They go out and they participate in something where they buy tickets to get in. And then once they get in, they have free access to everything that's around them. And at Disney, you're going to all the attractions and riding rides. At Burning Man, there's huge pieces of public art everywhere, many of which are interactive. And so, you know, like, the similarities are actually pretty fuzzy. And then when you take into account that Burning Man becomes like a dreamscape where many people build artworks that reflect what's happening in our popular culture, so you see a lot of Disney remixed and rebuilt at Burning Man. The whole thing becomes very fuzzy about the fact that they're supposedly quite different.
So they have that in common, and yet the premise of Burning Man is that we're not going to recreate anything, that there's going to be no recreation of the same old fairy tale, that this is going to be something creative and novel every time we show up here.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the premise in some ways. At the same time, you know, there's clearly a culture that's taken hold. You know, like any culture, it creates tropes, so that like there's very clearly a Burning Man aesthetic. It's very different than, say, a downtown Durham aesthetic. Like a Burning Man aesthetic, for instance, in a lot of cases involves women being topless with glitter all over their breasts.
Here in Durham.
Here in Durham, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
A Burning Man is very buttoned up. They don't do that there. Very buttoned up, dressed like pilgrims. It's very tapped down. But regardless, you know, you when you go to a place, you see the aesthetic in action, because, like, you watch people go by. It's not as though each person startles you looking completely different. You start to realize, my goodness, this too, you know, societies do that. They build their own forms. And that's not a bad thing. That's just an inherent part of being human, is that we match and synchronize with each other.
And you say, though, that when it comes to Burning Man, that you would never have considered going there. And you got the feeling that this is a calling that people have perhaps from birth.
Oh, yes. When they're young, they know that they're going to go. I did not have the calling. I was intrigued. I think a lot of people are intrigued. But if I was not called by work, by the desire to understand it so that I could talk about it, I never would have made the leap. I'm really glad I did. You know, like a lot of things in my life, like the need to understand them in order to tell stories about them is a very human impulse. And it's been very good to me. Like, I'm glad I went, but I definitely would not have had the guts to go on my own.
You didn't have it. It was not written on your soul.
No, it was
the
not.
Day that you were not. Born. And also, there's a kind of magic, a little bit of illusion, and perhaps deception. I mean, when you get to Burning Man, the whole thing is, well, no money will change hands, but a few bucks have changed hands to get you there.
Oh, of course. I mean, the framing of it revolves around money. And this is interesting because I thought that was going to be not very profound because of that. I thought I'm very interested in class issues in my work. And so I was so aware that almost everyone at Burning Man comes from enough money that they can take time off and go into the desert for a week. So the fact that we're not spending money is kind of like, well, whatever. It doesn't matter. But it actually turned out to be really – it actually is profound to be surrounded by tens of thousands of humans and no one is exchanging money. And people are only having a gift-based economy, which is not barter. Just people are just giving things to other people. You do not realize how loud the sound of commerce is until you're with a lot of humans and commerce isn't happening. I did not actually experience that ever in my life in the same way. And it was actually very profound.
The afterthought, as you say, in a sense, was Zuccotti Park for you. Tell us how that came about and your experience with that.
Well, my experience with Zuccotti Park is actually really – it's really valuable, I think, I hope, to share with other people. My experience is actually, I think, the dominant experience, which is I didn't go to Zuccotti Park. And so I talk very clearly about seeing it happening in my city just a mile – and I'm a – you know, culturally aware person who's very interested in personal liberties and all these issues. And I talk through how I came not to go. In fact, I went to an event for 30 and 40 year olds who were politically engaged with the causes of Zuccotti Park, but were in some sense afraid to go to Zuccotti Park. I went to that event and I spoke at it and we all had a big discussion about how we felt and we were like 1 mile away from Zuccotti Park. We could have gone to the park and stood in there and represented and had the same conversation. Yeah. And so I talk about that tension and I think it's valuable because obviously the majority of people feel the same way, that there's sort of this feeling of dorkiness and a fear of showing up and a fear of participating because, you know, we talk about like, well, what if the cops, what if things happen, but really more than anything, there's just this fear of like being dorky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because if everyone in my city, for instance, who was politically engaged with that cause had gotten over their dorkiness and all those people had shown up, we already had a lot of change come out of the Occupy movement. I really wonder if we'd be having a different conversation about what had happened to the banking industry, because I think if all those people had shown up, you'd have 10 times as many people. And I think that, I think even more change would have been possible.
So in a way, it underscores the power and the danger of a place like Zuccotti Park. Would you say, I mean, the fact is it's this tiny little park where a bunch of dorks show up and I'm afraid to be associated with them. But I agree with everything they're saying. And you say that and you get all your friends. So therefore, occupying that space is a dangerous thing. Certainly it was dangerous to Mayor Bloomberg. He actually broke the law to bust it up, right? I mean, that's how dangerous that space was to the establishment, to the status quo, and to those who may have thought it's time for that to change. Dangerous for them too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think very corrosive. And I think that these different sort of visions of utopia, you see in their lifespan some degree of like whether they take care to insulate themselves from the dominant paradigm. You look at Disney has been going on 60, 70 years, these parks. And one of the reasons it persists and has such a powerful place in our culture is it reinforces the dominant paradigm and help to forge it to some degree. You look at something like Burning Man, 26 years it's been going on. That survives in large part because it promises that it will not politically engage with the larger paradigm. And conveniently, it happens in the utter remote desert wasteland far away. There's no chance that any of this will ever leak out and get back to the world. And that's one of the reasons I think it's allowed to stay. You look at something like Zuccotti Park, 2 months. Two months. Because even though it's smaller by scales of magnitude than both those phenomena before it, it's in the heart of Wall Street. And it's by its presence doing an incredibly provocative thing by occupying that space.
And promised out loud and said, we are apostolic. It's about changing the paradigm, not withdrawing from it and protecting ourselves from it. Fascinating stuff. You know, I have to ask you about this now. This American Life, I want to change gears here and talk about something that happened quite a while ago, the agony and the ecstasy of Steve Jobs. You said that, in fact, you created this story and much of what you said wasn't true about that experience. You've had time now, and you have since apologized for it. You've expressed your regrets about it. It became very popular. This American Life had to do the same thing. Backpedal. They made mistakes, and they acknowledge their mistakes. You've had more time to think about it. How do you reflect on that experience now?
Well, I think one of the integral things to understand about it, and this is really offered not as an excuse. It's not. I'm very honest and open with my apologies. But, you know, when we say much of that story, you know, after everything had happened, after the Führer had passed, I revised the monologue and I didn't shirk from the public eye. I kept performing it. And in order to revise the 2-hour monologue so that it would be completely factually accurate, I had to remove 5 minutes. So when we say much of the story, the essential bones of it, the bones of what is the labor situation overseas and what is the shape of it, were true every single time I said it in every context it was ever said. So, you know, and where I sit today, honestly, I spend a lot more time thinking about that labor situation. I'm really unbelievably happy about how much change has happened in the last year, like since this became so public in such a huge way. I may not have been totally happy with the ways in which it became public, but I cannot argue with the amount of energy the scandal itself poured into people staring at this. And it gave a lot of energy to hardcore journalists. It gave permission to their editors to say, well, we'd better tell the true story. I mean, the story was always sitting there, but now they had permission to tell it. And you can see the Times has done great follow-up reporting. Like, things have changed at Foxconn already, and things are changing across the electronics ecosystem, and the labor situation there is altering. One of the Apple executives anonymously sourced in the last Times story on this said, because of the changes at Foxconn, the change happening now, that the era of cheap globalism is over. And I hope he's right. I hope that's true. And I'm like very happy to be in a world that's fundamentally shifting in that direction.
Can you, as a monologuist, and without those 5 minutes, as you say, the bulk of it was accurate. So, you know, the question is, well, why not just tell that? Why not start out with a story? And I'm moving now, say to an idea like American Utopias. Again, allowing us to think about how we use our spaces, what we think is the dominant paradigm, and how we see ourselves over and against. There's some deep thoughts here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, is it best to frame it as, look, this is a kind of fiction, this is a performance and theater, or does it work better as nonfiction? And how do you think you can have the most effect, the most power in what you do? Do you need to frame it as journalism, or is it better just to call it theater and not toy with this other idea?
Well, you know, a lot of the framing of how you get to that position, that's a question that comes up a lot, and it comes a lot, honestly, from journalists especially, and it makes sense because in their idiom, it's really hard to understand, like, how could there be something that's not true? Because the life of the journalist very often is, like, very focused on, like, the bones of the story being absolutely factually true. So that makes sense. But what may not be apparent is that when you work as a storyteller, that wasn't your central concern. It's a concern, but it's never actually a central concern. And so by the time you have told a story for 2 or 3 years, over and over again, orally every night, and then someone comes to you and says, I'm going to give you an entire show to finally tell the story to other people, enough people, that something might change. People have to make a decision about how they're going to play their cards. And I made my decision, and that's how we ended up where we are today. And I'm okay with that. I'm living with the ramifications of that every day. But to the larger point of, like, you know, what do you call stories? How do you frame it? I think about this all the time for the last year. And one of the things that is an outgrowth of all this is that I no longer fully believe in nonfiction. I think all stories are fiction. We have a great responsibility to the truth, but all stories are fiction.
The latest truth, American Utopias. Mike Daisy, thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Mike Daisy's latest work called American Utopias, playing through Sunday at PSI Theater of the Durham Arts Council. Just ahead, live music on the state of things. Anna Rosebeck, stay tuned.